When was the last time you held dirt in your hands, smelled it, and cleaned it from under your fingernails? Dirt, soil, land is a part of who we are, literally at the cellular level. Carbon, nitrogen, oxygen. And land is the source of the food that we need to live and becomes a place where we belong, where we spend our days, and eventually the place to which we will return. Each season on Complexified, we explore how a core issue connects to religion and politics. We do this by hearing stories and insights from experts and friends. This season, our focus is on land. Land is religious, a central element in sacred texts and rituals across traditions, and called upon to justify stealing land and extracting resources. Land is political. Enlightenment thinkers like John Locke brought their ideas about land ownership and land use to the political institutions of the United States. These founding perceptions of land, who has access to it, how we care for it, continue to shape current issues that impact every area of our lives. We'll dig into a few of these over the coming weeks as we meet with biblical scholars, experts in indigenous land law, environmental scientists, political leaders grappling with our homelessness crisis, and immigration advocates at the U.S. southern border. Along the way, we'll ask how our ideas about land shape who belongs in the United States. This is Complexified, where religion and politics collide. I'm Amanda Henderson.
I'm Roxy Stone.
And I'm Caitlin Beatty.
Saved by the City is a podcast from two Christian women cracking the code of faith from the mean streets of New York City.
Our podcast captures what happens when purity culture meets hookup culture, when distraction steals from devotion, and when the diversity of viewpoints and lifestyles clash against assumptions.
Gotham can be a weird place for Christian women, but we're out there and we have stories to tell.
Saved by the City, wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for listening.
I have exciting news to share. We started Complexified a little over a year ago, and it has been a full learning experience, a playground and an opportunity to build community with those who want to let go of simple answers and embrace the complexity of real life. Complexified is a project of the Institute for Religion, Politics, and Culture at Iliff School of Theology. And we are embarking on a new partnership and joining the Religion News Service podcast network. Welcome to all of our new listeners. We're excited you're here. This is a podcast for the religiously curious and politically frustrated, you and me. Each episode, we invite scholars and activists, faith leaders and thinkers to help us uncover the complexity of our most entrenched issues so we can get unstuck and imagine new ways together. Today, we welcome Dr. Amy Erickson, a professor of Hebrew Bible at Iliff School of Theology. Dr. Erickson teaches on the interpretation of the Hebrew Bible, what many people call the Old Testament. She's written on Job, Jonah, the Psalms, and she's currently working on a book project on the Hebrew Bible and ecology. My favorite thing about Amy is that she so clearly loves land and nature. Being in it, studying it, weaving it into her reading and teaching biblical texts. When launching into a series on land, it seemed wise to begin with a biblical scholar, since many of the subtle yet impactful ways we understand land and belonging in the U.S. today are drawn from our interpretations of the Bible. When I met with Amy, we jumped right in and I asked her a small question. What does the Bible say about land?
It says many, many, many things about land. Often things that contradict one another and things that are abhorrent to us, things that are exciting to us. So there's a whole range of expressions about sort of land theologies.
Yeah.
And I would also want to start by saying there is somewhat of a difference between what the Bible says about land and our interpretations of those biblical texts. And it's really hard to differentiate between those things sometimes, but it is always fascinating to me to try to figure out what are the assumptions I bring to the text about land. So, for example, can people own it? I've had students say this before, like, of course they had private property, right? Not necessarily. There's no evidence in the Bible to suggest that land could be sold or bought within Israel. So within the Assyrian and Babylonian empires, there does seem to be evidence that it could be bought and sold. But within Israel, you could only inherit it.
Interesting.
So that's just an example of how different the Bible reads when we bring our assumptions to it. So, but I would say on the whole, there's really kind of a continuum in the Bible between loving the land, feeling deeply rooted in the land, feeling utterly connected to the land as if it is essential to one's identity. And then on the other end of the continuum, land is basically a storehouse of materials and resources that we can extract things from. Now, I'm going to go so far as to say, I don't think that position is advocated for in the Bible, but that has very much been a part of the way, in particular, Genesis 1 has been interpreted.
Where are the primary locations that we're pulling our ideas about land in the Bible?
So I think a big one is Genesis 1. It's right at the beginning. It's a powerful text. It has that sort of liturgical repetition to it. So people call it to mind easily. And it has this sort of human-centric view of land and creation that is actually unusual for the Hebrew Bible. So there are two places in the entire Hebrew Bible that say something like humans are like gods. Humans should have control over or dominion over land. Two places. So Genesis 1 and Psalm 8, and that's it. And the rest of the texts, the rest of the texts have this incredibly low anthropology, which is, watch out, humans cannot be trusted with too much knowledge or too much power. And so we have to maintain a very hard distinction between gods and human beings. So most of the texts you read are like, humans are made of dirt. They're like worms. They're totally
dust.
Mortal and fallible. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So there's this historian, his name is Lynn White, and he wrote this essay in like 1967, where he basically blamed the environmental crisis on Christianity in general, or Judeo-Christian traditions, he said, and Genesis 1 and another text from Genesis, that big land promise to Abraham for the environmental crisis, saying this is the taproot of the environmental crisis, humans having dominion and control. But I think that he is reading through these interpreters coming up in the Enlightenment, 16th, 17th century, who read the text that way. So Locke, in particular, John Locke. Do you want to set him up for us? Because I'm sure you know more about him than I do.
Yeah, John Locke is so formative in our perceptions of land in the United States today as ownership and property ownership and what it means to be human and what it means to be Christian is tied to how we steward land or cultivate land or extract from land.
Exactly. So you're there. So Genesis 1 and the verse to have dominion and to rule over and subdue, or really better, conquer the earth, for Locke meant extract everything you can from it. It is your sacred duty to do that. And because the indigenous peoples in North America weren't doing that, they didn't deserve to partake of the riches of private property. So it's actually a way to take land away from indigenous people by saying they're not working it hard enough, basically.
And he literally quotes Genesis and uses biblical quotes, even though he's not a religious thinker or a theologian. He's more an Enlightenment philosopher and political philosopher, but he directly draws on these biblical texts.
Yeah. And You know, I mean, I don't want to say that Genesis 1 is a perfect text for environmentalists, but it's not nearly as bad as Locke makes it out to be. Locke and others, you know, Francis Bacon, I just wanted to read you a little thing that he says. He says, "It's our human labor in science and industry that will enable us to redeem and realize our original blessing and call to subdue and rule over all creation as gods." So the better we get at science and industry, the better we will be able to live into the sense of ourselves as gods. Now, you know, the writers of the Bible would be rolling over in their graves if they heard that this was the interpretation that people came away with, having read this hymn to creation, this ode to an orderly, flourishing, teeming world, teeming and flourishing in all realms, you know, from the seas to the skies to the land.
What have you read in that biblical text that points to that interconnected relationship that you're speaking of?
Yeah, well, so you can see it in Genesis 1. I think you can see it better in Genesis 2. So we can go there, and it's a little more obvious because the sort of human as worm element is easier to see. But even in Genesis 1, you've got the creation of the world divided up over 6 days. And over the course of those 6 days, obviously the refrain is God made X and so, and it was good. God looked and saw that it was good. So all of these realms of creation, the skies, the seas, the heavens, they are all called forth to flourish. And in particular, the fishes and the sea monsters are given the same blessing that humans are, which is to be fruitful and multiply and fill their domain.
We're not supposed to squash all the other living beings. We are one of many of the living beings from
exactly.
That.
Exactly. Yeah. And so people come down on, well, then why does it say that humans are supposed to conquer the land and rule over it, right? Like that's the one that it's really hard to wrap our head around. And I've got to say, I have been wondering about this verse and studying it and putting different questions to it and putting it in different contexts for about 20 years. So I'm not saying that there's an answer to the question. I think that because Genesis 1 was written during a time when the Israelites were not living in the land and more than anything wanted it back. So they can't imagine being whole as a nation without being in the land. We want it back because we want to be good stewards of that land. We are the only ones who really understand the intricate design of creation. So we got to conquer, or God has to conquer, really, whoever might conquer it, in order to get it back, in order for that land to be ours. We want sovereignty in our own land. So I think that's what it's about. I think that's why that language is there, even though it feels so jarring to us. Like, how could that be? But it goes hand in hand with having the land be essential to your identity and living in a society where they're warring all the time over territory. And little tiny Israel is at the mercy of these larger empires who are, you know, displacing them and marching through their homeland on a regular basis. Their armies are coming through, you know, going from the Northeast empires and coming down into Egypt because they're always sparring with Egypt. So their land has become a battle zone to some degree. And so they're in their mind saying, we'll take better care of it.
What did taking care of the land look like for them?
So for the most part, and this is fascinating, right? So you think about biblical scholarship, and you think about biblical scholars.
Yeah.
Where do they live? In libraries, right?
Yeah.
So for the longest time, people could not get the overarching sort of message and context of the Hebrew Bible, which is these people are farmers. They're subsistence farmers.
Yeah.
And so it was like maybe 2012, 2013, when Ellen Davis, who is a biblical scholar at Duke, basically takes the new agrarian movement and uses it to read the Bible. And everybody's like, oh, not everybody, you know, some archaeologists and some wonky people had some sense of this. But for the most part, we're so urbanized and so shaped by our use of technology, our book learning, our
language, European, we're in our brain and books and knowledge.
Less
body and dirt.
So true. So when she started showing how not just a few texts, but the majority of texts, like the vast majority of texts, have this agrarian worldview, it kind of turned me upside down a little bit in terms of how I read the text.
I love that.
Yeah, powerful. So in terms of how they thought about taking care of the land, because that ecosystem in the Fertile Crescent, which is the birth of agriculture, right?
Yes.
This is where it all started, where people settled down and became farmers and figured out how to do this. They didn't have any of the things that we have, like fertilizer. Well, they had natural fertilizer, but nitrogen-based fertilizers.
Yes.
And I mean, they didn't even really have sophisticated irrigation. So the empires in the surrounding world, their world, were able to, in Egypt, they were able to rely on the Nile to flood their crops on a regular basis. And so they were able to create this massive empire because of the way they're able to store up food. And then on the Tigris-Euphrates, which is where the Mesopotamian empires are, they've got these two rivers and they figured out irrigation techniques. So they have these pretty stable, reliable ways of growing food. Israelites don't have that. They have... their ecosystem is particularly fragile in part because of the nature of the soil. So they are in these highland areas, we call them the central highlands. And so having to farm these rather steep sections of land that are rocky and are utterly rain dependent. It's dry land farming is what they call it. And, you know, I mean, even now you think about Israel-Palestine, this is not a fecund environment. This isn't a place where rain is falling and food is falling off the trees. And in response, this is a place where you really have to have generations of knowledge and experience to be able to survive. So their land ethic is very much about, this is where Sabbath comes from, right? That land has to rest. Otherwise it will not produce for you. You have to leave some over. You have to be very careful with the way that you farm, with the way that you think about cover crops, the way you think about your animals and how they're going to be able to have enough to graze on. So it wasn't just that they loved and served the land. Their practices of farming made it so that they had to. Otherwise, they weren't going to make it.
Yeah, pragmatically, your survival is tied to this land being healthy.
Yeah.
And continuing to flourish. How do these different interpretations of land and this disconnect that so many of us have between the story and the experience of agrarian life, how does that play out in the United States?
So I spend a lot of time in a place in Colorado that's in Teller County, which is
beautiful.
Absolutely gorgeous, right?
Yes.
So my husband and I and our kids, we have this little cabin up there. And it's, I mean, it's not Vail. It's not Breckenridge. It's a red county. We've got Trump supporters.
Yeah. It's
primarily
rugged.
It's rugged. Yeah. Yeah. And they love this area. They love the land. They love their freedom that they, you know, the way that they imagine freedom on this land. And the thing that we have in common, the thing that makes it so that we can be neighborly and can really connect is our love for this place and our fear for it. And what we're all afraid of is fire.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've had some close calls.
Yeah.
So when I think about the way in which land and identity are intertwined in the Hebrew Bible, I think about these people, their house burns down and they're worried about what happens from there. Oh, okay. My insurance pays me out, but they won't give me money to buy a house somewhere else. I got to rebuild here. And what happens if the land is completely destroyed, if all the trees are gone, you know? So it's, they don't want to leave this place. They want to be, they want to stay exactly where they are. Apparently, the more education you have, the farther away from your home you live in this country, right? And so there is this sense of our career comes first, our education is tied up in that, and we move around and we go where we need to go in order to acquire this ability to be upwardly mobile and to be professionally challenged and, you know, all good things, right? Nothing wrong with that. But it means that our ties to land are a little more tenuous.
Yeah.
I know a lot of us who are, you know, what they call us, the liberal elites, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, we talk a good game about the environment and wanting to protect the environment. But a lot of times we don't have that deep connection with the dirt, with the soil, with the flowers, with the animals that run around in our world, you know? So there's some distance. We see this like in the prophetic literature, where one of my teachers used to say it's old school rural farmers versus the urban elites. Yeah. And the urban elites are not the good guys in these texts. These are the ones who are not doing justice at the gate, the ones who are tricking farmers with all of their kind of legalese. And the prophets are furious about this, because if there's one thing that defines who you are, it's doing justice. And first and foremost, it's doing justice with regard to the land and the least of these. So that theme throughout the Bible is sort of assuming this rural positionality that I think liberal elites can be a little uncomfortable with, you know? Yeah,
just really disconnected from.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's easy to forget those ties when you're not seeing them and feeling them daily. We did a trip when I was with Interfaith a few years ago to the Eastern Plains of Colorado. And we were meeting with different people there. We met with a pastor and he drove us around the different farmlands and the different areas and showed us the waterways. And one of the things that he shared that has just stuck with me is the impact that the Denver Front Range, which is where our cities are and where all the growth is happening, were buying up the farms that are on the Eastern Plains of Colorado. And when they buy the water from underneath the farm, then the farm dries up. And when the farm dries up, that is not only detrimental to their land itself, but it also means that their schools can't be open 5 days a week because they don't have enough teachers and they don't have any more students. And the coffee shop down the street closes. And it affects both environmental ecosystem, as well as the social ecosystem and educational ecosystem, all because a new housing development on the Front Range needs water to water our lawns. So he really helped me see, like, oh, this divide is not the ways that we'll think about it around education or cultural divisions. It's about water and land and how we care for our environment together, that we just don't see it. And so we forget about it.
So my husband and I have been trying to learn to hunt, which is no easy thing. And I would say that 95% of the people I say that in front of are horrified.
But they also probably eat meat.
Oh, yeah. No doubt. Right. But it's fascinating because one of the things that comes to mind are the numbers of birds. So we know that most bird species are in decline because of habitat loss and 10 million other things that we as humans have done to their environments, except for ducks. And ducks' numbers are up like 30% over the last 20, 30 years.
Really?
Yeah. You know why?
Why?
Duck hunters. So because duck hunters know what's happening in the world of ducks, they know when their numbers are down and they know when there's a problem, and they're interacting with the people who are coming up with hunting licenses and trying to make decisions about conservation. But they also fight for the maintenance of habitats. Wow. So the conservation of wetlands and areas where ducks congregate, people who want to hunt them also want them to have places to live and to thrive. So I always am so impressed by people who like really understand the land based on knowledge of a particular species. We went for this retreat. How to learn to hunt, like if you didn't have anybody in your family who hunted or anything. And part of it was learning how to butcher an animal, an elk. We butchered an elk, like 20 of us. It took us all day. But what really was unbelievable is how knowledgeable this woman who was teaching us about butchering was about these different parts of the animal and where they came from in the animal and how to like honor these different parts by cutting them in a certain way, you know, and we're all like holding up different pieces of, you know, like, I don't know. We're like, what is this? Is this a tenderloin or is this like a foot? You know, I mean, we were totally clueless. And as I was talking to my colleague, Mark George, about this, who also teaches Hebrew Bible, and he's like, you know, the priests in Leviticus, they were butchers. So I start reading Leviticus and Mary Douglas, who's an anthropologist, on Leviticus. And when you start to imagine that butchery was central to the religious traditions and practices of ancient Israel, it's just another way in which their understanding of the relationship between land, animals, and human beings and gods is completely different from our own.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I love it so much. At what point did you start shifting, and how has there been a symbiotic movement between yourself and and your studies?
So I went through a very painful divorce about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Like really, really painful. I had a very close family all connected around this marriage and lost that really for the most part in the wake of the divorce. And I got together with my husband and we started fly fishing. We wanted to spend more time in the mountains. So we got obsessed with fly fishing. And to fly fish well, you have to know a river. And initially we were like fishing the way that you would expect. We started doing it the way that we think we should be doing, which is like, you know, basically river hopping and doing sort of fishing tourism. And we kept saying like, but I like fishing on the South Platte. I like fishing at home.
Yeah.
And we really started to embrace that and say, no, we want to be here. We want to be rooted and grounded here. So I start reading about fishing. I start reading about ecology, start reading about how everything is interconnected and in particular, how things are interconnected in our home waters, we call them. Mm-hmm. And then reading about kin and kinship and the way that ancient Israelites, for example, understood their relationship with the land and with animals in terms that, you know, to think about in terms of kin. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, could I build family from here? Could I like build family from the ground up? To think about family differently.
Yeah.
And it was so powerful. Not that it was a replacement for this family, but it gave me a grounding. It was totally healing. And it gave me this grounding to be able to, I think, try to build something more sustainable and real with the people, you know, our kids and the parents and the family who I was able to continue to connect with, and to do it from that place of being filled up and grounded all at once was just this extraordinary. So of course I'm like, wait a minute, I think the Hebrew Bible might have something to say about this, right?
I was gonna say, it's all very familiar.
And so here I am, you know, years and years and years in, still captivated by how the biblical writers tried to express this rootedness, this groundedness, and why it mattered so much.
Yeah. Sometimes people will ask me, some people just don't like the Bible. because all they think about is the horrible things that people have used to knock people over the head with it.
Yeah, that's real.
And we've talked about the ways that it's been used to justify extraction and domination. And at the same time, there are all of these beautiful layers of depth and relationality and both humanness and our interconnection with animals and dirt and the messy, difficult parts of life.
Yeah.
That's what the Bible's about to me is.
So right. Couldn't have said it better myself. Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's a gift to hear you as someone who has spent so much time studying in the Bible and then to also feel that out in your own body and life and experience and relationships. And I hope for our community here at Complexified that that's what we're doing too, is wrestling with, okay, how do we take these pieces and parts and act on it and take it personally and move?
Yeah. The pun in Genesis 2, which is the Adam, the human, made from the Adama, the soil. So in Genesis 2, the human being literally comes from the soil.
Dirt.
From dirt. Yeah. And is tasked to serve it and keep it the way you would keep mitzvot, the commandments. So it's such a different way of thinking about our embeddedness in land than even Genesis 1, which is sort of from above. This is like literally from below, you know, from this you will made, from dirt you were made, and to dirt you will return, you know? Yeah. So there's a real humility in that, actually getting your hands in the dirt and reading with dirty hands. How about that?
Yes. Oh, I love it. Yeah. Well, you need to schedule a garden Bible reading.
Exactly.
I love it. Thank you so much for your time and your gifts and for sharing with us today.
Thank you, Amanda.
It was so good to kick off our series with a Bible scholar to help us see the complicated and nuanced ways that the Bible has been interpreted and the ways that it continues to shape the way that we see ourselves and how we belong in this land. In our next episode, Shawnee Lenape scholar, author, and director of the Indigenous Law Institute, Stephen Newcomb, joins us. We will ask Dr. Newcomb how the founding of the United States and the near genocide of indigenous people were shaped by concepts and laws surrounding land. Thanks again for joining us. Check out our website at complexified.org and sign up for our monthly newsletter to continue the conversation. If anything inspired you or sparked your curiosity, please share this with a friend. And don't forget to like, subscribe, and leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. Complexified comes to you from the Institute for Religion, Politics, and Culture at Iliff School of Theology, and we are in partnership with the Religion News Service. Working hard behind the scenes is our student intern, Josh Perez. Thanks to our sound engineer, Jasmine Hunjin, and the team at Podcast Allies. I'm Amanda Henderson.